I'm Jen White. This is 1A. As the drama of the Olympics unfolds, many have been captured by the decision of four-time gold medal gymnast Simone Biles to drop out of much of the competition due to a mental block. She returned triumphantly and took home the bronze in the balance beam final. But her decision highlights a growing number of athletes standing up for themselves and their health, from Naomi Osaka's move to bow out of the French Open to female athletes pushing back on the over-sexualization of Olympic uniforms. From the Olympics and beyond, athletes are setting their own standards and simply saying no. Here to talk about it is Lindsay Gibbs, author and founder of Power Plays. That's a newsletter about women's sports. She's also co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. Lindsay, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Clinton Yates, columnist for The Undefeated. Clinton, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Well, Pithy Pants tweets this: it's one thing to win a medal with skills that most of us have no hope of replicating. It's another to have the courage to value your health and advocate for your well-being, especially in the face of steep expectations. How many lives can that lesson change? Clinton, athletes have always been outspoken, said things at times that have angered the public, but how is what we're seeing today different?
I think it's different because it's taught us all a larger level of humanity beyond just sort of what we can loosely put in the mental health box. I mean, I think what we've all learned from so many different people over the course of this Olympiad is just how dangerous things like gymnastics really, really are. And so when you connect that to how the athletes feel from just a personal standpoint, we're reminded that, yeah, this is really, really hard work for a lot of people. And for what? Considering what we're looking at, maybe we want to reconsider what kind of sociological and psychological pressure we put on the actual athletes themselves.
Lindsay, why do you think athletes are getting more comfortable saying no and standing up for themselves?
Well, I think it's a movement, right? I think there's just more awareness of the connection between the mental and the physical. There's more examples of athletes really speaking out and reclaiming their agency, especially in a sport like gymnastics, where you've seen the survivors come forward, the survivors of sexual abuse by Larry Nassar, and just speak to the general culture of gymnastics where, you know, athletes often were told they don't have a right to their own body, that what they're feeling doesn't exist. And I think that's something that athletes from all sports have experienced in their lives. And I think it's part of this larger movement of athletes using their voices and using their platforms and kind of taking their agency back from a sports world that often likes to treat them like trading cards.
Mm-hmm. Now, when Simone Biles announced she was stepping back from much of the Olympics competitions, she got a lot of support, but there was also a fair amount of backlash. Clinton, what do you think was at the root of that backlash?
I think in general, when black women take back their agency in any particular part of this globe, that people react violently to it. I think that people aren't used to seeing athletes do that. Number one, those who look like Biles does. And number three, somebody who's so high at the top of their sort of expectation slot. That was a big part of it. I think that people have a real issue with folks just saying, I'm good. I'm not doing this because you all aren't worth it. I'm worth more. That's as brave as anything she's done from a vault or apparatus standpoint, in my opinion. And I'm quite glad that we were all here to see it.
Lindsay, your thoughts?
Yeah, I completely agree with what Clinton said. You know, I think that people are, we've so enmeshed this narrative of pushing through pain at all costs, whether it's physical, whether it's mental. That's where, you know, our heroes are born. And I think we're just now beginning kind of a societal reckoning of the cost of that. And it's so important that, as Simone Biles said, the cost of this for me, for the team, for anyone is not worth it. And I refuse to play this game. I refuse to give in. And that's a change the status quo. And we know change the status quo, especially when they come from black women. There's a large faction who aren't going to handle that well.
Do you think that I did the whole push through the pain, this is where heroes are made, is that something unique to sport? Is it something that is uniquely American? What do you think?
I certainly don't think it's unique to sport, although I think that's where we value it above all else. I mean, I think we're all, you know, I think maybe just this pandemic have we started to talk about, well, maybe going to work sick and, you know, working through illness and pushing through burnout. Maybe that's not the healthiest thing for us. But, you know, I always think back to the narrative that I grew up with Carrie Strug. I mean, I remember watching Carrie Strug land that ball in 96 on one foot and thinking that she was a hero. And not to take anything away from what she did, but the actual story behind that is so different than the one that the broadcast networks told us. You know, truth was, that was the last real thing, event of her career. She was only 18 years old. She was seriously injured, and she didn't have to do that vault for the U.S. to win gold.
Clinton, the two most high-profile recent instances of athletes standing up for themselves is Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka. A journalist, Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, writes that this is no accident and, quote, admitting vulnerability was always anathema to Black Americans striving to win in all kinds of hostile environments. And this is something you've written, that Osaka deserved more support from the tennis world. What are your thoughts on Black athletes in particular speaking up for their own health?
I think the overlap with Biles and Osaka is in that they walked away, but the approaches that they both took to this were very different. I think that Naomi was looking at this from a very specific personal protection plan entering the situation. You had, I don't know, different historical and geopolitical forces in terms of the fact that she's Haitian and Japanese and she was dealing with the French press and neocolonialism and all that other stuff. But I think for Biles, it was just a matter of her saying, you know what, this is too much. And I think for Black athletes overall, the fact that there are more ways than one to get to the same protection of one's own peace is important at this point in 2021. We don't all have to sort of say or do the same thing to realize that at some point you come to a point where you can't do what you're there to do. And if that's the case, then maybe you shouldn't be there at all. And I applaud both of them for managing to get to where they needed to be, whatever path it may have taken.
Lindsay, is some of what's at play also that these athletes have more control over their own narratives now that they have social media platforms? There's Twitter, there's Instagram, there's Facebook.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I want to be careful. Like, it's so important what Naomi Osaka and Simone Biles have done, and it takes so much courage. But I think a lot of the narrative around it has been, well, look at the medals, look at the slams that Naomi has won, look at the medals that Simone has won. She doesn't owe anyone anything. And I just think that we want to get to the point where anyone is allowed to take these protections, right? Even if you're, you know, the gymnast who just qualified or, you know, not at the elite of your sport. You shouldn't have to earn the right to care for your mental health and your personal safety. But absolutely, I mean, I think that, you know, both Naomi and Simone have built up power independent from their sport and their institutions. I mean, Simone is running her own post-Olympics tour because she didn't want to run it with USA Gymnastics for understandable reasons. You know, Naomi's endorsements make her the highest paid, you know, female athlete in the world. And so both of them are in unique positions financially and social capital-wise. And I think the example they're setting is a good one. But I just hope that the narrative, you know, doesn't become that you have to have their level of accomplishments in order to do what they're doing.
We're talking about growing athlete autonomy with Lindsay Gibbs. She's author and founder of Power Plays and co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. Also with us, Clinton Yates, columnist for The Undefeated. We also want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on athletes standing up for their health? Has it empowered you to see them do it? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. So athletes are pushing back on things that are making them uncomfortable this year, and that's also coming up in the way of uniforms. Germany's women gymnastics team opted to wear full body suits, while the Norwegian women's beach handball team was fined for not playing in bikinis. Lindsay, what's going on there?
Well, it's just ridiculous. I think that women are sick of these outdated rules about what they should and should not wear, these rules that have nothing to do with performance and everything to do with kind of catering to the male gaze. I think that first of all, if you, you know, there are athletes who want to wear, you know, the traditional uniforms of the sport, and that's fine. I don't want to shame that. But it's great that these women are coming forward and saying, it shouldn't take me being in my skimpiest clothing in order for me to be able to perform at the highest stage. Like, there's no correlation here.
Do these moves to challenge the uniform standards, do they actually have an impact on the sport and on the governing bodies?
Well, I think that, you know, any pushback is good and can, you know, help change the rules. So I'd like to think so, but I think we're only kind of in the very beginning of the movement when it comes to talking about, you know, men, predominantly white men, determining what women are and are not allowed to compete at. And I want to say this goes for, you know, this can go in multiple directions. You know, you still have players across the globe fighting to be able to wear hijabs in competition and being told that they can't and that it's dangerous. And on the other hand, you have, I know beach volleyball this year went somewhere where bikinis were banned and the women were told they couldn't compete in their bikinis. And they were protesting that because they didn't think that was fair. And so, you know, this is, it's a complicated topic. And, you know, the answer isn't 100% more modesty. I think it's more allowing women to make these decisions for themselves because they don't impact the sport.
Clinton, Alice Deering, who's slated to become the first ever Black woman to represent Great Britain in swimming at the Olympics this year, spoke out against the ban on sole cap. And this is a swimming cap made for natural Black hair. Give us a little bit more background on that.
Yeah, so FINA is the governing body that runs swimming basically on a global scale. And what they ruled was that for this Olympiad, basically you can't use the larger swim caps, claiming something along the lines that they do not follow the natural direction of the head, with a weird implication, basically the Black folks are unnatural. And the reason why that's problematic is because A, obviously that's foul. But B, I think it sort of peeled back the curtain on a large part of the culture that keeps Black folks, specifically Black women, out of the pool specifically from the beginning. You know what I mean? Hair safety is a real part of life. And so if that becomes yet another thing to weaponize against athletes as a reason why they can't compete, just like so many other things we found, you know, this summer, it's just it's odious and it's wrong. And I think that this is something that, again, falls in line with everything else we're saying. It's not just, as Lindsay said, it's not just about, it's about letting anybody do whatever it is they feel they need to do in order to compete at the highest level. And if that's a swim cap, if that's what they wear, you know, to compete in on the sand volleyball or whatever it may be, like, these rules just look and sound so insanely arcane. Like, if you look at the actual rulings of what these shorts need to be and what they actually say, you're just thinking, who did this? Who wrote this? And then you remember and you realize that's why we're all trying to make it different.
Well, how did Alice Deering push back on this ban on the sole cap?
Well, the sole cap ban, I mean, look, there's a larger issue at hand, I think, than just Alex Deering. I was actually talking to Candace Cooper about this. She was the first Black woman that ever swam at UNC. And she said it's not just about sole caps. It's about the way swimsuits are constructed as well. It's about everything around the sport in terms of what you can wear from a gear standpoint. So, you know, I support everybody and what they're trying to do. It's just that sometimes you got to look at the larger image of what's actually happening. And for Black folks, specifically Black women in the pool, not a lot of things working in your direction.
Well, story after story, there seems to be a lot of anger towards the IOC. That's the International Olympic Committee. I mean, Clinton, how are you seeing a shift in how athletes themselves are viewing these institutions and systems?
I think talking about it is the first step. You know, I mean, all of the Olympic committees are kind of the oldest and the crustiest of all of these sort of global entities in terms of who's running what. So, like, change is probably going to be the most difficult. This is not the WNBA. This is not MLS. This is not even something as close to our hearts and our minds as the NFL. The Olympics are the oldest of old school. So when it comes to these kinds of changes, I think it's going to take a lot more strength, singularly from athletes, because they don't have the traditional paths of support from their communities until they get to the actual games, which is, you know, only one part of the 4 years that it takes. So it's going to take a lot of strength and a lot of effort and a lot of courage.
Lindsay, what about for you? How are you seeing a shifting relationship between athletes and the IOC?
Well, I think it's the start of a long process. I mean, the amount of power the IOC has, like Clinton said, is just, it's so out of this world. It's almost inconceivable, the amount of power they're trying to hoard. And I think you see it right now most with athletes who are finding ways to protest during these games, and the IOC trying to have these arcane and, you know, really anti-human rights, you know, stances on protest. And, you know, right now, Raven Saunders, who, when she won her silver medal in track and field, she put an X above her head on the medal podium after the anthem was played. And even USA Olympic Committee, which I don't give much credit to, is saying, you know, we're not doing anything. We're not punishing them. And the IOC is still saying, we're looking into it. We're looking into it. And, like, that's just absolutely ridiculous.
We'll get more into the rules around protests at the Olympics after the break. But here's a tweet we got from Chris, who says, I was a little disappointed, but I certainly understood when Andrew Luck retired after multiple injuries as an NFL quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts. But he made a decision that was good for him, not to prove himself on the field for the fans or the money. And Matthew tweets, I work in health and safety, and I see the same trend with the current generation in work settings. They are no longer sacrificing their bodies and minds for the employer like the generations before us were proud to do. And I wonder, Lindsay, is this really a generational thing that extends beyond sport to your mind?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, I think that there's a lot of people, you know, I'm of the millennial generation who's kind of lived through all of these recessions, came into the workforce during it. And I think there's certainly an awareness that hard work isn't going to win you respect and protection from the people you're working for.
Clinton, your thoughts?
I'm 40 years old. I'm glad I made it this far, and I'll be damned if I let some employer kill me so that I can't enjoy the rest of my years on this earth.
We're discussing athlete empowerment with Clinton Yates. He's a columnist for The Undefeated. He also has a new podcast called Black History Always. Also with us, Lindsay Gibbs, author and founder of Power Plays and co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. In a moment, a former Olympic gymnast weighs in on the movement. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. This is 1A. Now let's get back to our conversation on a growing movement of athlete empowerment with Lindsay Gibbs, author and founder of Power Plays, that's a newsletter about women's sports, and co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. Also with us, Clinton Yates, columnist for The Undefeated and host of the podcast Black History Always. So Lindsay, the International Olympic Committee came down with new protest rules where athletes can express themselves before the game or during their introduction as long as it isn't targeted against people or countries. You mentioned shot putter Raven Saunders and her protest. What else have we seen from athletes?
Yeah, we also saw Race Embiden, who is a fencer. He wore a black X with a circle around it. Apparently, a lot of the U.S. athletes were in a group text and decided that that X symbol was going to represent the intersection of where all people who are oppressed meet. And Race has previously taken a knee on the medal stands, I think at the Pan Am Games as well. But you've also seen some, you know, more interesting protests. Like there was a gymnast, Luciana Alvarado, from Costa Rica, yes, an 18-year-old from Costa Rica, who incorporated taking a knee and raising a fist for the Black Lives Matter movement into her floor routine. And, you know, was very specific about the fact that this was part of the Black Lives Matter movement. And, you know, that kind of gets around the sanctions since it's part of her choreography. And I expect that we'll see a little bit more as the rest of the track and field competition moves on. And I, like I said, especially from U.S. athletes, be on the lookout for that X, which is about intersectionality.
Now, Clinton, take us back in history a bit, because the games have often been a political stage.
Oh, yeah. I mean, probably arguably the most famous image in the history of the Olympics, at least as far as Black America is concerned, is, you know, John Carlos and Tommy Smith holding up black fists. And I just want to say more separately, though, that like the very notion that the Olympics felt the need, the IOC, to regulate what people could do after they've even won is just an indication of exactly what you're dealing with in terms of the institutional blocks that a lot of people have and they have to come up against. I mean, you win a gold medal, you should be able to do whatever you want, presuming you're not hurting anybody, which arguably nobody's there to do anyway. That's the reason for the entirety of the fellowship of the game. So, you know, different protests we've seen over the years aside, I mean, just think about why the rules are the rules, and that takes you to a big part of the problem.
Lindsay, what kind of paradigm shift could happen with this growing empowerment for athletes and the businesses who make money off of them? Because there's a lot of money in play.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately you're going to see the sponsors, who are usually not the good guys, right? But sponsors want to work with these athletes. They don't want these athletes to be sanctioned. And sponsors are such a big part of the IOC's, you know, income. And for the IOC, it's money and power, money and power, money and power. And so, you know, I expect that you're going to see them getting pushed back. You know, the sponsors don't want their athletes afraid to use the stage or having medals taken away. You know, they want to be able to, you know, partner with these athletes. So, you know, that's not usually the saving grace. It's not the saving grace I would hope it would be. But ultimately, I just think the IOC, it's lost. It's lost this fight. Like, just stop it.
Clinton, what about you when you think about the money piece of all of this?
Look, my larger thoughts are that whether or not we're even seeing Olympic Games in 20 years is a different discussion for a variety of reasons. Money will be part of it. But I remember earlier in the games when Toyota said we're not airing ads, and they were one of the main partners of the IOC. So the money is always something. I mean, I think that we're all beyond the notion that Olympic glory is sort of all that, you know, really counts in this. I think a work of colleagues of mine in this business, guys like Travis Waldron, who have been pointing out that, like, listen, what happens with the Olympic Games is really about driving money towards certain people. And it doesn't necessarily help the host cities. It definitely doesn't necessarily help the athletes, because we've heard so many stories about people selling off their gold medals years later because they're just, you know, adrift because they spent their whole life trying to get to that stage. And then everything else afterwards was very difficult to come by. So, yeah, money's obviously a huge part of it. But I think the 2021, or whatever you want to call it, Tokyo 2020, because they're still using the name, whatever you want to call it, has given us a very different perspective on why we're doing any of this at all. And all you got to do is take a look right outside of the stadiums where they're doing the competitions.
We're talking about athlete autonomy with Lindsay Gibbs, author and founder of Power Plays, a newsletter about women's sports, and Clinton Yates, columnist for The Undefeated. Let's bring another voice into the conversation, former Olympian Samantha Peshek. She is a 2008 Olympic silver medal gymnast. Samantha, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. And I got to say, I'm impressed. No one ever pronounces my name correctly on the first try.
Well, kudos to all of us. Let's turn to this voicemail from a listener. This is Kathy from North Carolina.
I've been a high-level competitor myself in the sport of fencing. And I've always been taught, and on my own accord, realized as an athlete, you have to deal with pressure. And it's part of competing. In gymnastics, it's different because if you fall, you could kill yourself. Now, in fencing, it's just you could just mess up and lose a bout. But I think it depends on the sport with regard to how you respond to it if you feel like you can't compete.
We also got this email from Eric who said, I was disappointed to hear that Simone dropped out of the competitions. I was upset that she stepped down and how that would affect the teammates. Once I saw for myself how shocked Simone was in the air when she didn't know where she was, I understood and applauded her decision. And Samantha, Simone Biles said she was struggling with what's known to gymnasts as the twisties. Can you explain what that is and what kind of risks it presents?
Yeah, you know, it's crazy that the word twisties is kind of becoming mainstream now because it's almost like a industry secret lingo, so to speak. But yeah, the twisties is basically when your mind and your brain is not connected to your body. So you kind of have this moment before you're going for a skill and you forget what you're supposed to be doing during the skill. So you could go for it and you basically just get lost in the air and have no idea where you are. And when you're doing as hard of skills as Simone Biles, getting lost in the air, there's really no room for error. And so the risk is much higher than if she were to just do like a one full twist in the air. So I think the gravity of the difficultness of her elements makes it so much more dangerous in that respect as well.
How have you been reflecting on the way athletes like Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka are speaking up for their own health?
You know, it's really interesting, and it's made me think about my own journey, of course. And I think it's really, we're in a really unique time right now because it's something that you haven't seen in Olympics past. And I think it's a conversation that everybody is just at the beginning of, and I'm glad for that. I think that it's great to recognize just how much pressure these athletes are under on the biggest stage in the world. And it's really hard to put that in words, even for me who has been on that stage. But I remember when I was competing internationally or at that level, and we didn't really have a sports psych person to talk to or really anybody helping us through that mental side of sports. And I'm sure some athletes at the highest level, you know, may do that. I know MLB players, pitchers, the importance of a sports psych person in their everyday training, and it's really not been the normal for gymnastics. So just speaking in terms of gymnastics, I hope and I really do think that this is going to create such a positive shift in the way that we're training young athletes, not only to make sure that they're still physically as strong as possible, but to make sure that coaches are allotting that time for them to work on their mental toughness and their mental strength when it comes to pressure situations.
You know, gymnasts tend to be younger athletes, often thought to peak in their teens. You yourself started at the age of, I think, 2, became an Olympian at 16. That's really a lot of demand on a young person. What effect do you think age plays on how gymnastics has handled its athletes and how athletes fare in the sport?
Yeah, I think you know, gymnastics does have a benefit in terms of age in a lot of ways, because sometimes I feel that, you know, if you're really young, you're kind of deer in a headlights where you're just taking the moment in, you're not really feeling the pressure. You're almost naive to the big stage. But since this is Simone's second Olympics, I wonder just how much that played into you know, her feeling even more pressure. I mean, not only is she coming in the face of the Olympic Games, but, you know, she knows she can win. She wants to win. Everybody is kind of counting on her to win. And then, you know, on top of that, knowing what the pressure is going to feel like during those moments. Whereas her first Olympics, you don't really know what it's going to be like until it's over. And sometimes I think ignorance is bliss in that sense.
What about around this issue of autonomy? When you start a sport very young, are there people around you? Was it your experience that there were people around you saying, you know what, Samantha, if you're not comfortable with that move, you don't have to push too far? You know what I mean? Somebody really empowering you to say no.
Yeah, yeah. I can only speak, you know, with my own experiences, and I was so lucky to have amazing coaches that it always felt like a team effort, even when I was 10 years old. And I've always had a big mouth anyway, so I don't think I would have reached my full potential if that wasn't my relationship with my coach. But I actually dealt with a lot of fears at a young age. I had to repeat some levels because I couldn't do the elements that my friends were doing. And so for me, fears years, and having this sort of mental training has always been part of my gymnastics training, even at the highest level. And so, you know, I don't know Simone's history when it comes to fears, or if she's worked with sports psych, or what her everyday, you know, mental routine is in the gym. But for me, I know that it was such a crucial part of my success in the gym. And if I didn't feel comfortable with something, you know, I would always speak to my coach about it, and he would, you know, have me do drills that day, or not do something on the hard ground, or, you know, really just talk me through it to make sure I felt comfortable when the time came for me to salute.
Now, you've opened your own camp for young gymnasts called the Bean Queen Boot Camp. What do you hope for the generation of gymnasts you're working with? How do you hope they approach the sport, and how they think about saying, you know, yes to certain things, or knowing when to draw that line and saying no?
Yeah, well, you know, I created it because it's everything I wish that I had at a young age. The balance beam used to be my nemesis. I almost quit gymnastics because I had so many fears, and it ended up becoming my best event and my favorite event. So I wanted to include everything that coaches don't really have time for in a typical practice. So we do an entire rotation just on confidence training with these young athletes. What does confidence look like? What does it feel like? Where do you get it? And how do you keep it? Are some of the things that we actively talk about with them, and really just the importance of how powerful your mind is, and the fact that your mind really controls your body, in an effort to, when they are in those pressure situations, they can go back and rely on that positive mental self-talk that we are practicing versus that negative route of, what if I mess up? There's so much pressure. Everybody is counting on me, et cetera. So, you know, I'm really excited about the teaching and the coaching and curriculum that we're offering these young kids. But actually, after this Olympic Games, it's kind of made me rethink, and made me want to add even more of an emphasis on mental health in our program. So that's something that we're going to try to focus on for the future as well.
And for those of us who are watching these athletes from the comfort of our couches, what do you hope we understand that we wouldn't normally understand because we're not in the sport?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hate that we've seen some hardships during this Olympic Games at the expense of everybody realizing just how tough the sport of gymnastics is. I mean, the gymnasts are actually judged on how easy they make the skills look. And so a gymnast's job is to make these really difficult elements look easy. And so the fact that everybody, I think, is noticing just how tough it is, and just how tough mentally it is as well, I think is just opening everybody's eyes up. And I think really appreciating the sport and what the gymnasts are able to do even at such a young age. So I think it's good because it brings a lot of awareness to the sport of gymnastics. And I think it's also good in a lot of ways that it's going to push the sport of gymnastics to continue to change for a more positive way.
Lindsay and Clinton, we've got just about a minute here. What will you be watching for within the Olympics and beyond to see whether or not this movement continues? Lindsay, I'll come to you first.
I think I'm going to be looking at what these organizations and teams do, whether they continue to add mental health resources like Samantha was talking about, and just continue to prioritize helping people with not just the physical side of the game, but taking care of their mind as well. It's time for resources and action.
Clinton, what about you?
I'm looking to see what the U.S. women do if they win this basketball tournament. The WNBA has been at the forefront of a lot of these movements, and a lot of the sisters that are on that team are a big part of that. What they do is going to be the light that I think a lot of people follow, and I'm ready to check it out.
That's Clinton Yates. He's a columnist for The Undefeated. He also has a new podcast called Black History Always. Also with us today, Lindsay Gibbs, author and founder of Power Plays and co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. We were also joined by Olympic silver medal gymnast Samantha Pashek. Thanks to you all. Martha tweets this: I think it is people learning more to say no and looking out for themselves. I learned this at my first job. Remember to subscribe to the 1A podcast. It's where you'll find our best guests and stories every day. Today's producers were Michelle Harvin and Rupert Allman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.